In these three studies, I want to look at the book of Amos. Now today, in this first study, I want to look at the introductory sections, and that will take us up into chapter 3. Then the second study, we will see the main body of the book and the main concerns which Amos has. And then the third study will be a section at the end, chapters 7, 8 and 9, which are concerned with a number of visions which Amos had. Amos, one of the minor prophets, provided, of course, we don't understand the word minor to mean that he was unimportant. I think the word minor prophet means that their books are shorter than those of the so-called major prophets. And also the word prophet, it doesn't mean that he was a person who necessarily predicted the remote future. A prophet was above all a preacher, the messenger of God, bringing God's message to the people of his time. In Amos, you'll find that only the last few verses of the last chapter really predict something which was in the more remote future as far as the people of his time are concerned. There are, of course, other predictions in the book, because Amos, like all of the prophets, is saying, if you believe and if you repent, then these blessings will follow. If you don't repent, then these judgments will follow. So there is that element of prediction there. But what I'm saying is that we must not get the idea that a prophet is essentially a person who forecasts. A prophet is essentially a person who speaks as God's representative. He brings God's message to the people of his time. Now, the people of his time, we find in verse 1, are those who lived in Israel during the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and Jeroboam, king of Israel. At this time of Israel's history, the nation was divided into two. It's called the time of the divided kingdom. There was the northern part of the country, which had 10 tribes, and the southern part of the country left with only 2 tribes. Now, this northern part of the country with 10 tribes continued to call itself Israel, and it had its capital in the city of Samaria. And it's that part of the nation that Amos is concerned with. The southern part of the nation had only 2 tribes. It called itself Judah. Its capital was in Jerusalem, and it was this smaller southern part of the nation which continued the reign of the kings of the dynasty of David, reigning in Jerusalem. Now, Amos actually comes from the southern part. He comes from Judah, from a village here called Tekoa. But it wasn't very far from the border of Israel, and we find that what happens is that Amos most likely takes his produce. He was a farmer, he was a person who looked after sheep, and he also had fruit trees. He would take his produce to Bethel, which was across the border in Israel. And as he sold his produce there in Bethel, he saw some of the evils of Israel, and he brought God's message of judgment against Israel, that is, against the northern kingdom. First verse, the words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel, the northern kingdom, in the days of Uzziah and Jeroboam. Our next job then is to go and have a look at the days of Uzziah and Jeroboam to see what we can learn from them. So if you can just keep your finger there in the book of Amos, we'll go back to 2 Kings chapter 14. 2 Kings 14 introduces us to this man, Jeroboam. He is Jeroboam the second. Jeroboam the first was Jeroboam the son of Nebat. He was the bad person, you'll remember, who first took the northern tribes away from the southern tribes, and he set up his own false gods in the northern and southern towns of his newly formed kingdom. That was Jeroboam the first, Jeroboam the son of Nebat. This one is Jeroboam the second, and he's no relation at all to the first Jeroboam. He simply happens to have the same name. In 2 Kings 14 verse 23, if you skip over those first few names there, we come to Jeroboam the son of Joash, king of Israel. He began to reign in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. That's a very long time, 41 years. 24 tells us that he was bad, and verse 25 tells us that he restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah. That's important. He restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath, which was in the far north of Israel, bordering on Syria. Right from there down to the Sea of the Arabah. The Sea of the Arabah is the Dead Sea. and that formed the border with Judah to the south. That was the largest extent that any king of the northern kingdom ever ruled. Now if you come down to chapter 15, verse 1, we're introduced to Uzziah, who also had the name of Azariah. Azariah or Uzziah or Uzziah. He was the king of Judah in the south. Verse 2 tells us he was 16 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. So we have Jeroboam reigning for 41 years in Samaria in the north, and Uzziah reigning for 52 years in Jerusalem in the south. If you go across to 2 Chronicles chapter 26, we have the details of Uzziah given there for us. The first two verses of 2 Chronicles 26 tell us again that this man Uzziah was made king. Verse 3 again that he was 16 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. You come down to verse 6 and it tells us that he went out and made war against the Philistines. The Philistines were the people who occupied the coastal territory, the Mediterranean strip to the west. He defeated them. Verse 7 tells us that not only against the Philistines was he successful, he also was successful against the Arabs, and they were in the area to the south and southeast. Verse 8 tells us that the Ammonites fell under his control. The Ammonites were the people who bordered Israel to the east. And the last part of verse 8 tells us that his fame spread even to the border of Egypt. Which means that here in the south, Judah likewise expanded west to the Mediterranean coast, south as far as Egypt, southeast over the Arabian tribes, and east over Ammonite territory. You put the two together, the north and the south, and you find that Jeroboam and Uzziah between them governed an area greater than any king had governed since the golden days of David and Solomon. This was an era of tremendous growth and prosperity. The two kings were able to expand and develop their kingdoms partly because the previous nation or the previous dominant power in the region, Syria, had declined. The up-and-coming power in the region, Assyria, had not yet made its power felt in this part of the world. So, untroubled by outside interference, Jeroboam in the north and Uzziah in the south brought about this great development and prosperity. You find further reference to Uzziah's prosperity if you go down to verse 9, where he strengthened and fortified Jerusalem and made many great buildings there. In verse 10, he built towers in the wilderness. He hewed out many cisterns, some sort of water conservation, dams we'd call them today. He had large herds, and he had farmers, vine dressers, and agricultural prosperity was the order of the day. Verse 11 introduces us to his army, and it tells us how huge it was and how well equipped. You go down through the next few verses, which we won't read, telling us the numbers in his army. You come to verse 14, and we are told that he equipped it with the best weaponry available. Army had shields, spears, helmets, coats of mail, bows, stones for slinging. Verse 15, in Jerusalem he made engines, catapults of some sort that he put on the towers and the corners of the city wall. These were invented by skillful men, and they were able to shoot arrows at the enemy and throw great stones at them. His fame spread. He was very strong. And so you have the picture then of the growth and development that took place under these two kings. Now if you can go back to Amos, we'll pick up the story there. This was a great turning point in the history of Israel and Judah. The countries were passing into a more developed style of life. It's very similar to the sort of thing that you find happening in the so-called developing world today, where countries are coming from a fairly primitive sort of society into a much more developed economy. And with this come all the evils of city life: greed, prosperity, selfishness, corruption. And you find that the important people in the country are no longer the farmers, but now the important people, the rich people, the upper class people, are those who are the merchants, the civilian rulers, the top bureaucrats, if you like, the politicians, call them what you will, and of course the religious officials as well, the priests and the prophets. And by prophets I don't mean the good prophets like Amos, but I mean the professional prophets around the place who were the professional preachers. These were the people who were profiting from this prosperity. So you have summarising it all, expansion, stability, national development, prosperity, an increase in trade, development of city life, and with all this coming corruption. The merchants, the officials, the judges, the priests, the upper classes in general being the people who prospered, and the poor farmers were the people who were ripped off by the wealthy. Now Amos didn't have to be told about all this. Amos knew about it. He had first-hand experience of it. He didn't have to read it in the papers. He himself had to deal with these corrupt merchants and greedy officials in selling his produce to them. And so he brings his denunciation. In verse 2, the Lord roars from Zion. He utters his voice from Jerusalem. And the pastures of the shepherds mourn and the top of Carmel withers. This is a blast from the voice of God in Jerusalem, where he dwells in his temple. The forested regions and the pastures wither under the heat of the voice which carries the wrath of God with it. And so that's the picture of denunciation that Amos opens with. Now for the remainder of chapter 1 and on into chapter 2, Amos brings God's denunciations on various nations. And it's interesting to note his method of approach here. Altogether there are 6 nations that Amos denounces. The first 3 are foreign nations completely unrelated to Israel. The second 3 are nations which are related to Israel. And then the final 2 are Judah and then Israel itself. You can see what he's doing. It's a method used by the preacher to attract the attention of his audience. I'm sure that as they heard Amos thundering away at the Syrians and the Philistines and the Phoenicians and these other people, they were rubbing their hands together. They could take lots of this. And then he moves on to 3 related nations, and maybe they're still rejoicing, but just listening a little bit more calmly. Then he comes to Judah, which is right next door, and things are getting a little close for comfort. And then finally, bang, he lands right on Israel. It's as if here in Australia, we could hear somebody thundering against the Russians who've invaded Afghanistan and all the evil things they do, sending people to Siberia, and they're going to get their desserts. And the people in Iran who are murdering the innocents, all these crazy religious fanatics, they're going to get God's judgment upon them. And maybe some of the folks in Colonel Gaddafi's Libya, God's going to come down in a heavy hand upon them. And we say, yes, yeah, that's good stuff. It's about time these people got put in their place. And then the preacher moves on to the second group of 3 and he says, and yes, the Americans, God's going to come down upon them too because of all the evils in their society. And we start to stop and think a little, and Americans, well, they're a little bit like us. And the Canadians too, across the border, they're in the Commonwealth. And the British, yes, God's going to give them their desserts. And we're starting to feel just a little bit apprehensive. And so there's the second group of 3. And then he comes to New Zealand. Yes, even New Zealand, God's going to come down on a thundering judgment upon New Zealand. And now we're really on our toes, because that's just next door. And finally the prophet comes right down and says, yes, and even Australia. That's just a comparison. But you can see the effect it would have had on his audience as he brought these thundering judgments of God, landing finally upon Israel, and then the remainder of the book is concerned with Israel. Now, I don't intend giving you great detail of all these judgments that he announces on all these nations. You'll find it takes up quite a lot of room in the actual text of the scriptures, but you'll find also that there's a lot of repetition, and the same form is followed in each of the denunciations. It starts off, as you see in verse 3, by saying, for 3 transgressions of such and such, and for 4, I will not revoke the punishment. Which means 3 would have been bad enough, 4 makes it absolutely inescapable. Sin has reached its fullness, sin has overflowed. The last straw has broken the camel's back, if we can use an up-to-date parallel to that ancient figure of speech. Judgment is going to fall. And in each case, some of the major cities are used. Now this first one that we're looking at here in verses 3 to 5 concerns Syria. And the chief city of Syria is Damascus. So quite often the prophet uses the name of a chief city rather than the name of the nation itself. He will then go on to say why God's judgment is falling. In the case of Syria here, It's because they have threshed Gilead with threshing sledges of iron. That's some sort of brutal torture or brutal form of rule which these people, these Syrians, inflicted upon the people of Gilead. Now Gilead was the area of Israel east of the Jordan River. Therefore, you find as you move on, God is going to send a fire upon the house of Hazael, and it shall devour the strongholds of Ben-Hadad. Hazael and Ben-Hadad were kings of Syria. That's the next thing you find in all these judgments, that God is going to send a fire upon the walls of the city, or send a fire upon the houses, which is another way of saying, I am going to destroy this nation. So that's the pattern. In each of these eight cases, for three transgressions and for four, I will not revoke the punishment. Because they have done this evil, therefore I will destroy them. So that's the first one, Syria, destroyed because of its brutality. The second one, in verses 6 to 8, deals with Philistia. Philistia was the coastal region, and the main cities of Philistia, mentioned there in verse 6 and verse 8, Gaza, Ashdod, Ekron, and Ashkelon. They are denounced in verse 6 because they carried into exile a whole people to deliver them up to Edom, which is another way of saying they engaged in slave traffic. And very often you'll find Edom is the middle man in this slave traffic racket that was being operated. Well, once again, in verse 7, God is going to send a fire upon the wall of Gaza. In other words, God is going to destroy the Philistines because of their evils. The third nation in verses 9 and 10 is Phoenicia, and that was on the coastal strip to the north of Israel. Philistia was to the south, Phoenicia is to the north, but both of them on the Mediterranean coast. And the chief towns of Phoenicia were Tyre and Sidon. And they are denounced in verse 9 once again because they delivered up a whole people to Edom. So again you find Edom here is receiving slaves and of course selling them off somewhere else. So God is going to destroy Phoenicia. So that's the first group of three. You now come to the second group of three. Verse 11 and verse 12 begins with Edom. Now Edom was descended from Esau. Israel was descended from Jacob. So Edom is Israel's brother nation, you might say. And God is going to destroy Edom because he pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity. His anger tore perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. This is something of the savagery and the hate that was there in Edom. Edom hated Israel, the brotherly people. It should have acted towards Israel as if acting towards a brother nation. But instead of doing that, acted in this opposite way. And so Edom will be destroyed, and the towns mentioned there are Teman and Bozrah. They were some of the chief towns of Edom. You come on then in verses 13, 14, and 15 to talk about the Ammonites, and in the first three verses of chapter 2 to talk about the Moabites. The Ammonites and the Moabites were the two races of people who were descended from the two daughters of Lot. You remember that there were children who resulted from Lot's incestuous relationships with his two daughters. Well, those children were the forefathers of these two nations of Ammonites and Moabites, so you might say they were cousins of the people of Israel. Well, the Ammonites in verse 13 are denounced because they ripped up women with child in Gilead that they might enlarge their border. Shocking tactics which these soldiers of Ammon inflicted upon the people in neighboring Gilead. Gilead, remember again, the eastern portion of Israel which bordered Ammon. Simply to enlarge their border. That's all it was. It was just a straight expansionist policy, and pregnant women were butchered in this shocking manner. And so God is going to kindle a fire in the wall of Rabbah. Rabbah was the chief town of Ammon. You come to chapter 2 and Moab is denounced because he burned to lime the bones of the king of Edom. Unrelenting hate and vindictiveness. Not enough to kill the poor chap and see him buried, but to dig him up again and then burn him and burn his bones to lime to get the last grain of venom exacted upon the people that they hated so much. Once again, you find the chief towns of Moab are mentioned, and Moab also is going to be punished. So there you have the second three nations. You then come in verses 4 and 5 to Judah. for three transgressions of Judah, and for four I will not revoke the punishment, because they have rejected the law of the Lord. They have not kept his statutes, but their lives have led them astray, after which their fathers walked. And so I'll send a fire upon Judah, and Jerusalem, its chief city, will be destroyed. But notice the shift in emphasis here. The previous six nations did not have the law of Moses. Therefore, they are not judged according to the law of Moses. Judah did have the law of Moses, and its judgment is severe because it rejected that law. Now, this is the sort of argument you get in Romans chapter 2, where it says that they who had not the law will perish without the law. That is, God has his law, you might say, written on their consciences to some extent. People know that it's wrong to carry out these acts of butchery. It's built into the very conscience of man as God created him. He may not have the law of Moses. He may not have the more detailed knowledge of God's requirements. But he has sufficient knowledge to know that these things are wrong, and God will judge him according to that knowledge which his own conscience imparts to him. But when you come to Judah, when you come to the people of God, they have a fuller knowledge of God. Therefore, God has a more strict requirement of them. And it's the same with us. We might look at some of the atrocities in society, and we may denounce people who do horrible things, and we say they should get God's judgment. Well, so they should. They know they're wrong. But let us not be self-satisfied or complacent over all this. If we have a greater knowledge of God, God has a greater requirement of us. And if we ignore God's law, as these people did, if we have not kept his statutes, if we have not walked in his ways, then God is going to come down upon us in a judgment. In other words, things which we do, which may not be as bad as the things which other people do, may attract a greater judgment of God, because he expects more of us, because we know more of his law. And so that's why Judah is denounced. And you come finally now to Israel in verse 6, and Israel runs on now right through to the end of the book. So from here on we're concerned with the northern kingdom Israel and its capital city Samaria. For three transgressions of Israel and for four I will not revoke the punishment. The first of the evils that is mentioned here is one of social injustice, and the second one, which is related to it, is one of religious corruption. And these two evils will run right through the book, social injustice and religious corruption. Now, one of the deals that the people had, and you find this developed a lot in the book of Micah, was that these rich people, as they gained more and more power and influence, would get the poor people into their clutches. The poor people couldn't pay, and so they'd have to borrow money from the rich. The rich would lend them money, but at exorbitant rates, and the people could barely pay back the interest, let alone pay back the debt. And when they couldn't pay back the interest, the people would then come to them and say, "Well, I will take your oxen as repayment." And so the person was even worse off than he was before, because now he had to borrow oxen to work. And so he got further into debt. And they would say, "Well, now we'll take your house as repayment, or your land." And that's what they were really after. They gobbled up the land. And so we have these great rich landowners devouring the country. And sometimes you find even the people themselves had to be sold into slavery to pay off their debts. Now, this is the evil that our friend Amos is denouncing. It's the sort of thing we see quite a lot of in the East. I know of cases in Thailand where the poor have to borrow money, and it's very common to have to borrow it at 10% per month. And I know of some cases where it's 10% per week. Now, no matter what you think of Mr. Howard, you'd have to admit that that is a pretty frightful interest rate to have to pay. It makes some of our present money lenders look almost sanctimonious. 10% per week, that's 520% per annum. You can imagine the social injustices which are perpetrated upon these people, and how the whole place gets itself into terrible turmoil, and so the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. "Well, for three transgressions of Israel and for four I will not revoke the punishment, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes." A pair of sandals, a debt as small as that, they would sell a person into slavery even for such a small matter as that. We would say in English, you'd take the shirt off his back, or you'd take the shoes off his feet. Well, that's exactly what Amos is saying here. You'd take the shoes off the feet of the poor. Verse 7, you trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth, and you turn aside the way of the afflicted. And the other issue here is that of religious corruption, religious pollution. When the people of Israel first came into Canaan, back in the days of Joshua, and you find it developed in Judges and in Samuel and in Kings, they were attracted to the Canaanite religions. The local Canaanite gods were called Baals, or Baalim. I-M is simply the Hebrew plural ending. They were gods of nature. They were supposed to control fertility. They controlled the crops. They controlled the herds. They brought increase in the family or in the flocks or herds that the farmer owned. When the Israelites came in, they said, well, our God is the God of nature too. He is the God of fertility. He is the great creator. And the next thing you know, they've combined the two, and they're worshipping Jehovah, more or less, as if he is some sort of super Baal. And then another thing they noticed was that these Canaanite religions often set up their worship places on the hilltops. And they could think back to their forefathers and many stories of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the people of Israel as they traveled through the wilderness and as they came into the promised land. They could think again how frequently people went up into the hilltops to meet God, to worship God, to erect altars. And so once again they were tempted to accommodate themselves to the local religions. This is a temptation that's always before us, that we tend to interpret God in terms of the local philosophy or local viewpoints. We're not worshipping God as he should be worshipped at all, but our thinking or our attitude towards God or our appreciation of God is coloured by the wrong values of the society in which we live. We've got to always be on our guard against this sort of thing. Well, the Israelites weren't on their guard enough, and so Baalism crept in. Now, associated with this Baalism was prostitution, and this was outlawed clearly in the law of Moses. Prostitution meant that at these Baal sites there were prostitutes, male and female, and these people were available for sexual rites. They're called fertility rites. And the people acted out with the prostitute in front of the god what they wanted the god to do. They wanted the god to give increase in the family, or increase in the flocks, or in the herds, or in the crops. So they went through these sexual fertility rites. They are a great abomination, which were denounced in the law of Moses, and they are denounced repeatedly by prophet after prophet. And you find them here in chapter 2, verse 7, second part. A man and his father go into the same maiden so that my holy name is profaned. That's a reference to these prostitutes. They lay themselves down beside every altar upon garments taken in pledge. Garments taken in pledge, here again, is a reference to the debts which the poor people ran up. And then these rich would take clothing from them as guarantees of repayment. Now, they had no use for the clothing. Rich people don't have much use for the clothing of poor people. So what they do is use the clothes to make a mattress. And they carry out their profane religious sexual fertility rites upon these mattresses made out of the clothes of the poor people. And it goes on in verse 8 to say that in the house of their God they drink the wine of those who have been fined. They impose unjust penalties upon these poor people, and when the poor people can't pay money, they say, well, we'll take your wheat or your grapes as payment. And so the poor people don't even have any produce to sell to get income. And they drink their wine, even in the house of God, all these revelries. Well, the prophet goes on then in verses 9 to 12 to contrast this behavior with the grace of God which he had shown to his people. He said, look, in verse 9, I destroyed the Canaanites, the Amorites, the people who lived in this land. He said, I destroyed them before you. These people, their height was like the height of the cedars. They were as strong as the oaks, but I destroyed him, says God. Also in verse 10, I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. I led you 40 years in the wilderness, and I brought you in to possess this land of the Amorites. And this is the way you respond to me. It's terrible, isn't it, the way very often we respond to the grace of God. This is the way they responded. He said, I raised up some of your sons for prophets. I raised up some of your young men for Nazarites. Nazarites were people who specially set themselves apart for the service of God. And three vows they took upon themselves were: one, they were not to drink wine; two, they didn't cut their hair; and three, they were not to touch any dead body. But he says, these Nazarites who set themselves apart by abstaining from these things, what did you do to them? Well, verse 12, you made the Nazarites drink wine, and you commanded the prophets, don't prophesy to us. You wouldn't listen to the message of God which was coming to you through the prophets, and when there were people who set themselves apart for the service of God, you forced them to foul up the service which they had dedicated themselves to. You have trampled underfoot every law which I have given you, says God. And therefore I'm going to trample you underfoot, he says in verse 13. I'm going to press you down in your place as a cart full of sheaves presses down. That makes us smile a little bit, maybe, the figure of speech. The heaviest thing that they could think of in those days was a cart full of sheaves pressing down. I guess we would say a steamroller. We don't have steamrollers, or power roller, or some sort of roller like this that crushes rocks. I'm going to steamroll you into the ground, God is saying. I'm going to press you down as a cart that is full of sheaves presses down. And you won't escape. My judgment is going to come upon you, crushing you. And in verse 14, flight shall perish from the swift. The strong shall not retain his strength, nor shall the mighty save his life. He who handles the bow shall not stand. He who is swift of foot shall not save himself, nor shall he who rides the horse save his life. And he who is stout of heart among the mighty shall flee away naked in that day, says the Lord. No matter what weaponry you've got, no matter how much you've increased the size of your army and made yourselves strong, nothing will save you from the judgment which I am bringing upon you. Well, that's the opening sermon which Amos brings to the people. The eight nations denounced, and of course he reserves the longest denunciation for the people of Israel. Now you can imagine that as he brought this message, the people, many of them, would have reacted with opposition to him and would have said, what right have you got to come here speaking like that to us? So Amos goes on in the opening verses of chapter 3, and I'll conclude at verse 8 of chapter 3. He goes on to justify his speaking like this. He says, hear the word that the Lord has spoken against you, O people of Israel, against the whole family which I brought up out of the land of Egypt. You only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. Note that. You only have I known, therefore I will punish you. That was contrary to what the people expected. They thought, we are God's people, therefore we will get God's blessings. God says, you are my people, therefore you will get my punishment. They thought that because they were God's people, they could do as they liked and yet still claim the promises of God. And there are many people among God's people today who are deceiving themselves in the same fashion. And the way they talk sometimes, well, it's a bit unrealistic, you'd have to admit. Talking only about the good things and the heavenlies and all the blessings which they expect to get without question. I'm not saying that these things are wrong, of course. I'm not saying that there are no blessings. All I'm saying is that people sometimes get distorted views of what is required of God's people. Certainly there are blessings, certainly there are privileges, but the greater the privilege, the greater the responsibility. And the more we neglect the privilege or the responsibility that has been entrusted to us, the heavier will be the judgment. God requires more of his people. Certainly God will bless his people with greater blessings, but certainly also he will give them heavy chastisement if they refuse, if they ignore the requirements he places upon them. You only have I known, therefore I will punish you. And from verse 3 to verse 8, Amos then gives a number of illustrations. All of them are taken from his own way of life in the country, a number of illustrations to justify his speaking with the uncompromising tone that he has been speaking with. What he says is this: everything happens for a reason. If I speak the way I have spoken, there's a reason for it. There's a reason for everything. For example, if you meet two people going on a journey together, it's because they have arranged it. That's verse 3. I know verse 3 has been taken right out of its context. Can two walk together unless they be agreed? And it's been applied to marriage. It says if you're going to get on happily in your marriage, you must be agreed. Well, of course, I agree with that. That is an obvious truth. In fact, it's so obvious, you don't really have to go to the Bible to justify it. But that's not what Amos is talking about here. I think you'll see as you move through that I'll give a sort of loose paraphrase of these half a dozen illustrations, and I think you'll see that what he's saying is everything happens for a reason. And if I speak the way I'm speaking, it's for a reason, and the reason is that God has told me to speak. So, if two people go on a journey together, it's because they have agreed upon it. They've made the arrangements to do so. Verse 4, if a lion roars in the forest, it's for a reason, it's because it's taken its prey. In verse 5, if a bird falls into a trap on the earth, it's because the trap has been set for it. Or, in the second half of verse 5, if a trap springs up from the ground and catches an animal, it's because an animal has fallen into it. It just doesn't go off for nothing. A bird doesn't get taken in a trap for nothing. It's because somebody set the trap. The trap doesn't go off for nothing. It's because something has fallen into the trap. And in verse 6, if somebody blows the trumpet, it's because an army is approaching and the people are afraid and they've got to be prepared to meet the army. And so it is in verse 7, he says that if God does anything, he reveals it to his prophets. Verse 8, the Lord has spoken, who can but prophesy? If I am speaking the way I am, it's because God has told me to speak. The lion has roared. Therefore you should be afraid. In reference back to verse 2 of chapter 1 where he says, God roars from Zion and he brings his thundering message against these sinful people. So he says, if I am speaking in these terms and you are fearing, it's not an accident. It's because God has given me the message. I am his spokesman and this message is burning in my soul and I am bringing it to you. And I trust that as we look at this book of Amos, we might again see that Amos was a spokesman for God. He was a person bringing God's message to God's people. And even though we may live in a different age, in different circumstances, I trust that we may see that message coming through to us. The Lord God has spoken. Who can but prophesy? God's message comes. It's up to us to hear that message and to make the response, and not to be like those people of Judah who rejected the law of God, who didn't keep his statutes, who did not walk in his ways, who ignored his word. As Amos's word comes to us, I trust that our response will be one of receiving the word of God and acting upon it.